This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Mandolin player and singer Ricky Skaggs started his career in bluegrass, became a country music star in the 80s, and returned to bluegrass in the 90s. In 1970, when he was 15, he joined Ralph Stanley's Clinch Mountain Boys. He later joined the Country Gentlemen and J.D. Crow in the New South, then formed his own band, Boone Creek. He left that band to back up singer Emmylou Harris. In the early 1980s, Skaggs changed direction and became one of the most successful of the new traditional country artists, recording 10 number one hits between 1982 and 1986. He won the Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year Award in 1985. In 1997, he returned to bluegrass and has been one of the leaders of its revival. His new CD, The High Notes, is a collection of some of his biggest country hits recorded with a bluegrass sound.
When the caller would holler, do-si-do, the new Uncle Ben was ready to go. Late in the evening, a-bouncing down high on the hill and above the town, Uncle Ben played a fiddle, Lord, how it rang. You could hear it talk, you'd hear it sing.
That's Uncle Penn, a Bill Monroe tune from Ricky Skaggs' latest album, The High Notes. As a child, Ricky Skaggs sat in with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs. Terry spoke with Ricky Skaggs in 2003 and began by asking him about his lifelong friendship with Earl Scruggs.
You've known Earl Scruggs for a really long time. Now, you played with him when you were seven back in 1961. How did you get to play with him?
My father never met a stranger, and we had met the backstage guard. His name was Mr. Bell, at the Grand Ole Opry, which was down at the Ryman Auditorium in those days. And Mr. Bell said, okay, I'll let you all backstage, but, you know, you've got to be nice and, you know, don't be bothering people, don't bug them and that kind of thing, you know. And because my dad was always trying to get me noticed, you know, by influential people. And so Earl Scruggs just happened to walk by, and I was standing there playing the mandolin. And he heard me play and got to talking to my dad and said, well, bring this little boy down next week for an audition on our television show, the Martha White television show. And we did, and I got the audition, won that, and they set a date for me to come in the studio and record it, you know, when they were – the next time they were going to be recording. And so that – I mean, it was as simple as that. It's pretty amazing to think that it was that simple, but it really, really was. It was just one of those – one of those magic moments in time that that really did happen.
So what did Earl Scruggs mean to you and his partner Lester Flatt when you were seven?
Well, you know, they were so popular. They were such a big group. I mean, they were so famous. And that was even before the Beverly Hillbillies. And, you know, they're Grand Ole Opry stars. And, you know, I'd got to play with Bill Monroe when I was 6 years old up in Kentucky. He came to our hometown and I got to be on stage with him. So I had a little taste of, you know, being around a star, but they were just so inspirational. They had such great music. They had a great band. The songs they sang were really, really good. I really loved the gospel songs that they sang. They really had a great quartet. And just Earl's banjo playing was so good, and it just inspired me to be good on the mandolin. I mean, I wanted to be I wanted to be good like Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and you know, Benny Martin, which was a wonderful fiddle player that used to play with Flatt and Scruggs years ago, and Paul Warren and Josh Graves, and those great players that they had in the band at different times. And so they were very inspirational. I guess personally, you know, they didn't take me on the road with them or anything like that, you know, but they were always nice to me and treated me with respect, you know, and encouraged me, you know. You know, this boy can go places, Mr. Skaggs, you know, you ought to keep it, you know, that kind of thing with my dad, you know. So they were wonderful people, and I just, you know, it was great to get to know them through the years. And Lester Flatt passed away, you know, about 10 years ago. And so it's unfortunate that he's not around to enjoy all this great thing that's going on with bluegrass and roots music these days.
So you start, you actually perform with Bill Monroe before performing with Flat and Scruggs. How did you get to play with Bill Monroe's band?
Well, he came to Martha, Kentucky, which is a little small town close to Blaine, Kentucky, where I was raised. And they played the high school, and we, my mom and dad and I, my brothers and sister went to see them. And we watched them unload, and, oh, man, that was the coolest thing to see them get out of this big stretch limousine that they were riding in. And it looked like they just walked out of the dry cleaners. There wasn't a wrinkle anywhere, you know. They looked so stinking cool. And they got the bass fiddle off, you know, off the rooftop, and they set up a little sound system. And we went in and sat down and listened to them play. And about 20 or 30 minutes into the show, some of the neighbors in the hood started, you know, requesting, let little Ricky Skaggs get up and sing, you know. And I see it in my own life now, you know, where people start, you know, making those kind of requests, you know, when I'm out on the road playing now. But after, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of that, why, finally Mr. Monroe said, well, where's he at? You know, and he didn't have any idea who little Ricky Skaggs was. And so I come walking up to the front of the stage, and he reaches down and picks me up and sets me on the stage and says, what do you play, boy? And I said, well, I play the mandolin, sir. And so he tucked his mandolin off of his shoulder and wrapped it around the, you know, made the strap fit me, you know, and I stood there and sang a Bob and Sonny Osborne song called Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man? For a six-year-old to be singing a song like that, you know. But it was the biggest thing that had ever happened, you know, to me in my life at that time, being 6 years old and getting to play with the father of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe.
Did you always sing? Like, you sang from when you were a child?
I did. My mother used to tell me stories. She's since passed on, but she used to tell me stories. She would hold me in her arms, and I could remember this. She would hold me in her arms in church, and I would sing harmony with her, and my dad would play guitar, and I would sing harmony with her. I was very young at the time, like, you know, 3-4 years old. And the worst thing about having to sing in church is I had to always give up my chewing gum. My mother would make me spit my chewing gum out, and that was a real bummer. I hated that. Just about the time it got really good, I had to give it up and spit it out. You know, that's just a bad memory.
Is there a certain harmony that's, like, wired into your head from when you were really young, a certain, like, interval that you always sang?
Right. I always heard the third. You know, that's the tenor line is what we call it. If the lead was the one, and the tenor would be the third, and the baritone would be the fifth. Usually the fifth would come below, you know, the one, the lead, until the Stanley Brothers moved it up above the third, which was really cool. But that's the part that I always heard. My mother said she would be working, doing her chores at home, cooking or whatever, and I would be in the other room playing with my toys, and she'd be singing in the kitchen. And she could hear me harmonizing with her in the other room at a young age. It was just, here again, it was just a gift that I could hear that part, you know. Because I guess because she would sing that part with my dad when my dad was home. He worked out of town a lot because he was a welder, and he had to travel a lot to wherever the best jobs were. And so I would hear them sing, and that was the part that made sense to me was the third.
Well, while we're talking about harmony, why don't we play a track from the CD, Three Pickers? And you're harmonizing on this with Doc Watson. And the song is What Would You Give? Are you singing a third higher than Doc Watson
yes.
on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love this song.
Yeah, it's a great performance. So here you are with Doc Watson and Earl Scruggs from the CD Three Pickers.
Brother afar from the Savior today, risking your soul for the things that decay. Oh, if today God should call you away, what would you give in exchange for your soul? What would you give
in exchange?
What would you give
in exchange?
What would you give in exchange for your soul?
exchange for your soul.
It's Ricky Skaggs singing with Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs on banjo from the new CD, Three Pickers. There are so many bluegrass and country gospel songs that are about death or about losing your soul. What did those songs mean to you as a kid? Were they frightening at all?
Yeah, I've had lots of counseling since then. No, I'm just teasing. The Little Girl and the Dreadful Snake used to scare me to death when I heard that song by Bill Monroe and Jimmy Martin back in the 50s, late 50s,
what's,
early
I don't
60s.
Know that one. What's the other?
The Little Girl and the Dreadful Snake. It was about this little girl that wandered out in the woods and got bit by a snake, and, you know, she dies, you know, and it's just, oh, it just made me so afraid of snakes, you know. Of course, I don't have a lot for snakes even to this day, but there was a lot of songs, like you said, about death and about, you know, death is real. I mean, a lot of people think that you know, death is just, you know, just a dream or something, but it really is real, and I guess with the Irish and Scottish influence in the mountains of Kentucky and western North Carolina, East Tennessee, and the Appalachians there, just our ancestors, we really knew how to grieve. And, you know, I know the Irish, you know, immigrants certainly grieved a lot because I think they really missed their homeland. And it was just part of something that, you know, I know my mother really grieved over my father or her father and of course, my father, too. When he passed away in 96, and she grieved, you know, till the day she passed away. And it was just something that she really couldn't quite deal with and get over, you know. And I don't know if it's a cultural thing that, you know, they think if you get over it that you don't care about them, you know, or is it something that you, you know, you just actually feel and, you know, and you're going through, and it's part of a healing process. But by and large, most of the music that kids heard was the same music that adults listened to, you know. And so if it had to deal with mother and her passing or the death of a loved one or the afterlife or faith, the salvation, or what happens if you don't have salvation, you know, and those kind of songs. And they were real, and they really did put a I don't know, they put something in, you know, in the back of your mind. They would challenge you to think, you know, and and maybe grow up.
What was your church like?
Well, we were foot washing Baptist. It's called, you know, it was Free Will Baptist. And
where does the foot washing come in?
the foot washing, they would take that, you know, Jesus did that to the disciples, you know, before, you know, at the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. And that was a, you know, the Baptists would do that. Certain denominations of Baptists would do that. Would kind of follow that that ritual, you know, around Easter time, that kind of thing. And it was usually after the service, but it was still part of the service. And the men would wash the men's feet, and the women would wash the women's feet. And it's a very, very humbling experience if you've never had a 75 or 80 year old, you know, man get down and, you know, and wash your feet as a young man. It's very, very humbling, especially someone that you've looked up to all your life. You don't feel worthy, you know, of some precious old saint, you know, that you've lived around all your life that you knew was a very godly man, to humble himself and get down on his knees and wash your feet. I mean, it's a very breaking of the heart, you know, and a very humbling thing. And it lasted many, many years, and now it's almost a thing of the past. You hardly ever hear of that anymore.
You had some classic 80s haircuts also. I think that should not go unremarked.
Those.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Mac mullet. I had a few of those those mullet hairdos. My kids look back at them now, and they said, "Dad, I can't believe that you had that." And I said, "Well, hey, it was the style then."
They made me do it.
They made me do it.
Yeah. You know, I'm just thinking, there's so many things that so many performers in country music do, because that's what you're supposed to do in country music. And at some point you wonder why. Like, why does it go on like that? You know, why? Like, some of the costumes and...
I guess in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s through the early 60s, you know, the nudie suits, the big flashy, all that, you know. I think there was a lot of artists that really felt that, you know... When a hard-working mom and dad came to the Grand Ole Opry and paid their money to come and see you, you know, you need to treat them the best you can treat them. You know, you don't need to be dressed just like they are.
Right.
They expect better. They've paid money. They don't want to see you dressed like they are. Because if they do, then you don't look any different, you know, even though you may sing like, you know, the person they come to see. They want to see you dressed to the nines, you know. And so I really think a lot of that was for show. You know, it was before videos. It was before, mm-hmm. you know, the big wide screens. And, you know, if you were setting 40 or 50 rows back, you know, one of those red flashy suits, you could see it all the way, you know, 80 rows back, you know.
Yeah, good point.
And it was just something about, you know, presentation. I think it was a theatrical kind of look, you know.
1996 was a really life-changing year for you. Your father died, Bill Monroe died, and you left country music and returned to bluegrass. Did the death of your father and the death of Bill Monroe connect at all with you returning to bluegrass?
Well, I think it did. Those two men were very, very strong pillars in my life. My dad, you know, had really taught me from, you know, the cradle. You know, he had really worked with me, very patient man, had worked with me and teaching me a lot about music and about how to play it. And Bill Monroe was such an inspiration. He was like a musical father to me. And I knew both of those men really wanted me to be playing bluegrass again. And country music in 96 was really starting to, I don't know, it was starting to really, really change. And I don't know, I just saw the writing on the wall. I mean, I was not new country anymore. The kind of country music that I was wanting to record was really what I had recorded since 81, you know, and pretty much traditional country music, you know, trying to find really great songs mm-hmm. that said something, songs that had a meaning and love songs. And that just didn't seem to be what was selling on the radio. And so I really felt, you know, too, in my spirit that there was a real paradigm shift about to take place. And I felt like that at Mr. Monroe's death, that there was really going to be a change in this music. I just felt like that when he passed away, that there was going to be, you know, just a new audience for the music. And I really think that that happened. I think that really, when I look back at it now, I really think that it did happen. I wanted to go back. There was no way that anyone could take Bill Monroe's place. And I didn't, I certainly didn't come back to take his place. But I wanted to come back and take Ricky Skaggs's place, because I really felt like that I had a place in bluegrass. And even though I got out of bluegrass, I took bluegrass with me into country music, and now I wanted to return with the knowledge and understanding of business and the understanding of recording and putting on a show. I wanted to take all the things that I had learned and come back, you know, and bring it back to this music. And I really started the record label and all that stuff. And so in 96, it was a bittersweet time. I mean, like you mentioned, my father passed away. Mr. Monroe passed away, but there was even with that death, there was a new birth and a new life that came from that. And I think it was a turning point in my career. A lot of people says, man, you're the smartest guy in the world, you know, but it was just one of those things that I felt in my heart that I really needed to do, and it was the right thing.
Well, Ricky Skaggs, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's great being with you today, Terry. Thank you.
Ricky Skaggs speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. His new CD is called The High Notes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. If you're a baseball fan who wishes your job took you to the ballpark every day, or if you're a casual fan who wishes you understood the game better, there's someone you should meet. Zach Hampel is a lifelong baseball fan who's managed to make a career of his obsession. His first book was about how to get a ball when you go to the ballpark. He snagged over 3,500 lifetime, most from batting practice. Stay tuned and you'll hear some of his tricks. His second book is a guide to the game's rules, traditions, and jargon, designed to reveal its secrets to those who wonder why players spit and scratch all the time, or what a hit-and-run play is. It's called Watching Baseball Smarter, a professional fan's guide for beginners, semi-experts, and deeply serious geeks. I spoke to Zach Hampel last summer. Well, Zach Hampel, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to start by asking you a simple question about the game that's probably puzzled a lot of people. I watched Wimbledon, and I didn't see any of the tennis players spitting. And I never see soccer players spitting or lacrosse players spitting. But baseball players spit in the infield, in the outfield, on the mound, in the batter's box, and even between their feet in the dugout. Why are ball players spitting all the time?
Because they're disgusting, filthy creatures, and spitting is part of baseball's culture. But more specifically, baseball involves a lot of waiting. That's part of why some people are bored with baseball, but if you know enough, you can realize that a lot of the waiting is some of the most interesting action, in a way, because there's so much going on. But baseball players have to fill up that time with something, so they chew sunflower seeds, tobacco, gum, and even if they're not chewing anything, they just still have to spit, because I guess that's cool.
Well, and I always figured that, you know, a couple of generations back, most of the big league ball players chewed tobacco, and you have to spit all the time, and it just became the macho image of a guy who was steeped in the game.
Yeah, tobacco is actually banned now in the minor leagues, so I don't know if that's supposed to get players to not chew tobacco or if it's just supposed to motivate them even more to get to the major leagues because then they get to chew that stuff. There are even some players who've chewed it since they were so little that they've developed some kind of immunity to the tobacco juice and they don't even need to spit it out.
Now, convince somebody who is not a fan that this game isn't a deadly, boring waste of time. Some folks just say, I just don't get it. I mean, the pitcher throws it to the catcher throws it back, they stand around, it happens again. How do you engage somebody who just doesn't get it?
That's not so hard. The first thing I would point out is that baseball really is a three-hour game that takes 3 hours to play. Other sports, though, basketball, for example, is a 48-minute game, which takes 2 hours to play, and football is a 60-minute game, which takes 3 hours to play. But baseball, there's a reason why it takes so long, and there's a reason why there's so much waiting and standing around. And the most basic way to get into that is the whole dynamic between the catcher and the pitcher. The pitcher has to know what pitch he's supposed to throw, and the catcher has to know what pitch is coming, because the ball comes in so fast, and there are different pitch grips and different spins that make the ball move in all kinds of different directions. The catcher has to know what to expect, but the pitcher can't tell him, okay, I'm going to throw this pitch now, and the pitcher can't give a sign or a signal to indicate that, because then the batter would see it, and the batter would know what to expect, and the batter would just crank the ball over the wall. So the catcher has to tell the pitcher what to throw, and he does that with a very complex set of signs, which he then has to bury in his crouch deep between his legs so that the first and third base coaches can't even peek in and see the signs. He has to look up at the catcher. The catcher also has to look up at the hitter every time he gives a sign to make sure that the hitter is not peeking back at him. And if there's a runner on second base, well, that guy is looking directly in at the catcher. So that just makes the signs even more complicated. You'll often see the catcher jog out to the mound and discuss with the pitcher, and they're basically changing the signs to confuse the runner on second base so that guy will not be able to relay those signs to the hitter. So there's this whole cat and mouse game between every single pitch, and sometimes the catcher doesn't even decide what pitch should be thrown. Often the manager will be calling the pitches from the dugout, so the manager will be giving a whole set of weird signs. If you ever see the catcher kind of looking over his shoulder to the side right before he turns towards the pitcher, he's getting those signals from the manager. So the manager gives the signs to the catcher gives those signs to the pitcher in such a way that other players on the other team can't steal those signs, and then even the pitcher can sometimes shake his head and disagree with the catcher and say, no, I don't want to throw this pitch in this situation. So that's why baseball takes so long, because every pitch you have this kind of strategizing and scheming and deception, and it goes on from both sides throughout the game.
Right. But that whole process of negotiating the kind of pitch and the location of the pitch and making sure the batter isn't seeing it is pretty much invisible to a fan in the stands. They're just waiting for these guys to get it straight and for him to throw it.
Yeah, I actually think that baseball is more interesting on TV. Now, of course, nothing can beat the in-person excitement of being at a ball game, but the way baseball on TV is produced nowadays, you have so many different cameras with different angles, and you can see slow motion and replays, and you can just get right up close and see things that you would never see from the stands. Even if you're sitting in the front row behind the dugout, you're not going to pick up on some of the things that you can see on TV.
Can you think of an example of a nuance of the game that you think kind of opens the door to somebody who's just learning about it?
There's so much specific stuff, little rules and weird quirks that you can look for when you're watching baseball. I think a lot of things that many people would never realize, just even small things like you'll see a base runner often holding his batting gloves in his hands. Once he reaches first base, you'll see him take off his batting gloves and just hold them. And you might not even ever notice this, and if you do, you might not think that there's any reason, but the reason why he's doing that is so that if he does end up having to slide into a base, he's forcing himself to make fists because he has to hold his gloves, and he's protecting his fingers from getting stepped on and possibly jammed or broken.
Really? I have noticed people holding their gloves, and I've always thought, why don't they just give it to the first base coach? They want their fists balled so they don't injure their fingers.
Exactly.
Let's talk about some of the etiquette of the game. One of the things you see in baseball is that it's okay under some circumstances to argue with an umpire. I mean, you don't see football players running out and argue. When is it okay to argue, and when is it not okay to argue, and how far can you take it?
Technically, you're not allowed to argue balls and strikes with the home plate umpire. That's supposed to be an automatic ejection. Of course, you'll still see players complaining and managers flailing their arms in the dugout. But, arguments, the whole manager-umpire dynamic, that's part of the game, man. I mean, you can see arguments really get crazy. There are certain magic words, which I'm not allowed to say on the radio, but if those words are uttered to an umpire, that's an automatic ejection. But sometimes the manager will intentionally get kicked out of a game. Or even if he knows that the umpire made a good call, he might still have to run out and pretend to be protecting one of his players. So he'll pick up the argument on his player's behalf so the player doesn't get kicked out of the game. A lot of it is just used to motivate the players and really get the team fired up. You know, a good argument can even get the hometown crowd going. And yeah, umpires know that the manager is just doing his job. Of course, sometimes it can get pretty personal and ugly, but for the most part, I think everyone knows what's going on when there's a heated debate on the field.
So it's okay if there's a play, an out, like if there's an out at second base that's called safe or vice versa, the player can get right in the umpire's face and argue. The manager can charge out of the dugout and argue. However, on a called third strike, if the manager comes out to argue, he's immediately tossed, right? You can get away with a word or two, but you can't get in their face on a ball strike call, right?
Correct, yeah.
There's also this... There are etiquettes and conventions about pitchers hitting batters with the ball. When are the times when it's sort of considered acceptable for a pitcher to deliberately plunk a batter with a baseball?
In my opinion, it's never acceptable to hit anybody with a ball. I think there are certain times when you need to throw inside to move a hitter off the plate. They'll call it chin music. You know, if you throw a ball near the hitter's face, or you know, you give the hitter a bow tie if the pitch is up and in. But if a team, for example, is just really hitting the ball hard and diving out over the plate and they're reaching pitches on the outside corner and they're hitting home runs, some pitchers will intentionally hit a batter just because they're mad or to prove a point. You know, well, you can't knock me around. But in situations like that, I think it's appropriate to pitch inside but maybe not hit someone. Of course, if one guy gets hit on one team, you'll often see a pitcher then they want to pick someone off on the other team, and it just sort of goes back and forth, and the retaliation can really get out of hand sometimes.
Well, and the terminology you'll see players using that situation is you got to protect your teammates. In other words, they hit one of our guys, and you expect your pitcher, even if he's going to get tossed out of the game, to go out there and hit one of their guys.
Yeah, and it's tougher in this new era with the designated hitter to the whole issue of protection, because in the old days, when every pitcher had to come up himself and take a turn in the batter's box, you know, if he wanted to hit someone on the other team, it was almost viewed as, okay, well, that's fine, because now you're going to have to stand up there too and watch what we're going to do to you. So it was like, you can give it, but you're going to get it. But nowadays, pitchers in the American League don't bat. So if they hit someone, they don't have to face the consequences, but unfortunately, one of their teammates often will.
Now, one of the things that will get you thrown at if you're a batter is what's called showing up the pitcher. Explain that.
If you're a batter and you hit a home run, 450 feet, 500 feet, doesn't matter. You don't want to stand there in the batter's box and pose and watch that thing. You don't want to finish your swing with your hands high over your head and flip your bat off to the side. You don't want to take your time running around the bases. You want to just put your head down, run around the bases, get back in the dugout, high fives, whatever, curtain call if the hometown fans call for it. But you see a lot of players posing and showboating because of ESPN and all these other sports networks that just show the highlights. And it's not enough, I guess, to just hit a home run and be great. You have to look great while you're doing it. And the pitcher can take that as an insult. And the next time that batter comes up into the box, boy, he better watch out.
And I think, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, that was much more likely to draw retaliation, right? I mean, you just weren't supposed to do that.
Not at all. Nowadays, the umpires have been instructed by the officials at Major League Baseball to prevent fights. So before you'll see things escalate on the field, often the home plate umpire will issue a warning to both teams, and that's pretty easy to spot. Basically, the ump will take a few steps toward one dugout and just point very emphatically towards that dugout, and he'll usually say that's a warning. You won't hear that on TV, but if you see the ump walk over and point, and then he'll walk over to the other dugout and do the same thing. And what he's basically saying is if anybody throws at anybody for the rest of the game, that pitcher and the manager will be ejected.
You know, one of the interesting kind of partnerships in the game is the catcher and the umpire. And again, you don't see this unless you really look carefully for it, but these guys are standing close to each other all through the game. And also, they got a guy throwing a ball 90 miles an hour at them. And once in a while, a foul tip will catch, let's say, the catcher's ungloved hand. What does the umpire then do?
Yeah, when the catcher gets nicked up by a foul ball or a wild pitch that bounces and hit him, the umpire will sometimes walk the new ball out to the pitcher just to give the catcher a moment to recover. The ump might even bend over and pretend to brush some dirt off home plate, some non-existent dirt, just to give the catcher a break. And conversely, if the umpire gets hit, well, the catcher will sort of wander out to the mound and sort of make it look like he's discussing strategy with the pitcher, but it's just all for show, and it's professional courtesy. It's to give the other guy time to recover.
Cover from that injury, right.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll often see the umpire throughout the game, when he's in his crouch and the catcher's in his crouch, the umpire will lean forward to brace himself and place his hand gently on the catcher's back. It's just, you know, these guys have such an intense relationship with each other. They're practically touching each other the whole game, and they're giving each other time to recover from being hit by the ball. And, yeah, the catcher tries to frame pitches. If a pitch is thrown, 2 inches off the outside corner, the catcher will just move his glove slightly to try to, convince the umpire and trick him that it was in the strike zone. And the catcher is very careful not to argue, when he's at bat himself, because he might make the umpire mad, and then the umpire won't give him the benefit of the doubt when the catcher is then behind the plate.
You know, Mike Schmidt, the Hall of Fame third baseman for the Phillies, once described being an at-bat, and a pitch came in that was low that an umpire called a strike. And what he said was he kept the bat on his shoulder, continued to look out at the pitcher, and said to the umpire, "It looked a little low to me." And he noted that the umpire appreciated him saying that while he kept his stance and looked at the pitcher. Why?
Mike Schmidt was not showing up the umpire. If he turns around, it's obvious right away that he has a beef with the umpire, that he's not happy, attention is drawn to the umpire, maybe he made a mistake. But yeah, just by continuing to look at the pitcher, you can't hear that if you're in the stands or even on TV. There aren't microphones right around home plate. So yeah, and the worst thing you can do as a batter is, drop the bat down and slump your shoulders and complain. Even worse than that would be, and I've seen this happen a couple times, instant ejection. If you're the batter and you think the pitch is a few inches outside, don't draw a line in the dirt indicating to the umpire where you think that ball crossed the plate. You just don't want to do stuff like that because umps have a lot of pride themselves. Even though no one is actually there to watch the umpire, yeah, you got to respect him.
You've made a bit of a career out of chasing balls in ballparks. You wrote a book about this, right? How to Get a Ball at a Ballpark?
Yeah, my first book is called How to Snag Major League Baseballs.
Well, it's interesting. I will confess that I looked at your blog and discovered an amazing coincidence, which is that you recently attended a game in Philadelphia, which I and a number of the producers at Fresh Air also attended. And in that blog, you said you went home with eight balls? including a home run ball. I mean, I would almost think you're telling us tall tales here. Give us some of the tricks for getting major league balls.
I should point out that of those eight balls, seven I got during batting practice, and one was tossed to me at the dugout after the game. So even the home run ball was a practice ball. I have caught home runs during games. I caught Barry Bonds' 724th career home run last year in San Diego. But just a few basic tips for people who want to go home with the baseball. You got to get to the ballpark early. You want to be one of the first fans to enter the stadium for batting practice. If you have just a ticket for the game, that entitles you to show up early and watch the players practice. Bring a glove, even if you think that, you know, it's not cool if you're a grown-up to bring a glove, or it's, you know, it's unmanly. Doesn't matter. Put your pride on the shelf and bring a glove to the game. I bring a hat of both teams that I'm going to see. I own all 30 major league team caps, because if I can kind of suck up and look like a quote-unquote fan of the visiting team, they'll be more likely to toss balls my way. I can also ask for balls in about two dozen different languages, so I'm always asking foreign players in their native languages.
Whoa, hang on there. I'm Iguchi. Ask for me a ball in my native language.
Iguchi is Japanese, so I would say, Choto, boro nagete kudasai.
This has worked for you?
Absolutely. I've gotten a few dozen balls by asking in Japanese. I got one at the last Mets game I went to. Masumi Kuwata tossed me a ball on the Pirates. It helped that I was wearing a glove, that I was the only fan in the section who knew his name, that I could speak his language. And I asked him in a polite way. I think the translation is just pretty much, please throw me the ball. I've asked in Spanish. I even used sign language a few times. There's a player named Curtis Pride who's 95% hearing impaired. And I used French once for a coach on the Expos. And I can even ask for balls in, you know, other weird languages, Bulgarian and Swahili and, you know, just Russian and German. Not that these are all weird languages, but in the baseball world, they'd be considered weird languages.
So you haven't found that Bulgarian infielder yet?
Not yet, but boy, when that guy comes up to the show, I'm going to be ready to say, Bili mi podal topkata.
Now, how many balls do you have from Major League games?
The current tally is 3,123.
Well, Zach Hampel, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Zach Hampel recorded last summer. In case you're wondering, no, he hasn't grown up. His lifetime total of balls retrieved now stands at 3,562. His book is Watching Baseball Smarter. Nanette Burstein directed the powerful Oscar-nominated boxing documentary On the Ropes and the fanciful Robert Evans biography The Kid Stays in the Picture. For her new film American Teen, Burstein filmed teenagers in an Indiana high school every day for 10 months, amassing over 1,000 hours of footage. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The bouncy American Teen is the rare documentary that could cross over to a demographically desirable young audience. Some critics have compared it to The Breakfast Club and other films that break your heart over how tough it is to weather high school. The movie is involving. The kids' raging hormones are right there in their faces, not just their bad skin, but their skittery eyes. But if the film is a hit, it's going to be because it takes messy reality and molds it into something pure Hollywood. Director Nanette Burstein tracked 15 high school seniors, all white, for a year in middle and upper middle class Warsaw, Indiana, then edited the footage to focus on five, the geek, the artsy misfit, the basketball player hobbled by parental expectations, the varsity hunk, and the rich, nasty golden girl. You think I'm caricaturing them, right? Well, the golden girl turns out to be a shade more vulnerable than we thought, but still a nightmare. The others are exactly what they seem to be when we laid eyes on them. And if they're not, Burstein makes them just so. She even illustrates their fantasies with animated sequences that look like video games or movies. American Teen might have a breakout role model in the artsy Hannah. You're on her side from the moment she narrates her own introduction.
So I'm a little different than a lot of people around here. Warsaw's such a conservative town, and I'm so not conservative. I don't fit in. I hate it. I like music. I like film, and I like photography and art.
Hannah, you have an M&M for energy. You might like that.
Yeah. I live with my grandma.
She's so thin, she reminds me of those models. She said she's been eating Whoppers.
My mom has manic depression, so it's almost impossible to live with her.
My dad moved to Ohio to work, so I'm basically just on my own for a while now.
When her longtime boyfriend breaks up with her, Hannah stops going to school. But then Mitch, the hunky varsity star, asks her out, and there's a happy montage of their romance. Other good things happen, too. The outcast Jake, whose pustuled face is a topographical map of teen hell, musters the courage to ask out a cute freshman athlete, arriving at her house with flowers.
Hey, Salon here?
Yeah. Lloyd? Hey.
Hello.
How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Wow, thank you. What are these for?
Just because.
Oh, thank you. These are awesome. I just got back from my game. I was smelling like crap.
It's disgusting.
I took a shower today and then did almost nothing. So I'm kind of just the opposite.
Oh.
I got my oil changed. That was exciting. So do you want to go see a movie Sunday?
Yeah.
As heartwarming as it is to see Jake get a date, it's odd Burstein never considers whether the girl said yes because there was a camera in her face. Or for that matter, Mitch dated Hannah because he knew she was one of the movie's subjects. Why does the rich girl, Megan, let Burstein film her making vicious crank calls? Why does Jake's girlfriend let Burstein film her cheating on him and then tell him she's not the kind of person who would do that? In the New York Times, A.O. Scott ponders the notion that members of the Facebook generation, which has grown up with reality TV, are more comfortable opening their lives to the camera than their elders, who are much more self-conscious here. But I don't think the kids' willingness to behave as if the camera isn't there lets Burstein entirely off the hook. In one scene, a girl picks up a text message from her boyfriend in which he breaks up with her. Did the crew happen to be there? Why is there a cut to a close-up as she reads it? Did Burstein know the breakup was coming? American Teen reminds me of those old animal shows where it turns out the crew nudged the gazelles in the direction of the lions with multiple cameras standing by. In interviews, Burstein has bridled at that kind of reaction, suggesting her critics have a problem with storytelling that's too accessible. I'd substitute the word superficial. American Teen doesn't deepen our understanding of what it means to grow up in this culture. It uses every up-to-the-minute trick imaginable to reinforce what we thought going in.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. We have some sad news about a friend and colleague at WHYY, where Fresh Air is produced. Jim Broxton, the maintenance supervisor at WHYY, passed away on Wednesday after a brief illness. He was 52. Jim helped keep this place together for nearly 25 years and could build or fix anything, from cars to buildings. He was all over the place, patching up our offices at WHYY. He removed old walls and installed new ones. He fixed the plumbing. He rewired our lamps. He built the shelves that we used to safely store thousands of pounds of Fresh Air archive tapes. But the real reason we'll miss him is that Jim was one of the sweetest and coolest guys around. He loved music and was a musician himself. So we'll close with a song that Jim would have enjoyed hearing on the radio. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
What in the world could be better than getting together? Yeah.
That's why your mama told you that you